In a democracy, power is vested in the people and in their elected representatives. Power in the people's hands may be stable in democracies like the United States or Britain, but it is anything but static. Citizens, politicians, and activists continually question and examine the appropriate role of government, and partisans on all sides jockey for influence, the right to define and implement their vision of a democratic government. I'm Susan McGinnis for KUAC-FM, and this is Conversations. Today we'll talk about the conservative revolution of the 70s and 80s in this country and what's coming of it in the 90s. My guest is Dr. Gillian Peel, Oxford University professor, a specialist in conservative politics, and an author on the subject. Dr. Peel, thanks for joining us today.
Pleased to be here.
I want to start with a global question, and if it appears a bit fuzzy, we can pull it into precision. But in your mind, was this country yearning for something in the 70s and 80s that responded so well to Ronald Reagan's call for a new dawn in America, a new day in America, and to a revived condemnation of communism, to a change in the way government practices its daily business?
Yes, I think it was. I think this was very much a country which in the mid-1970s, felt that it had lost its way, where there was a very real question mark over the presidency, over American foreign policy, over American culture, over the future direction of American policy, both at home and abroad. Part of this was the result, I think, of two traumas which left really very serious marks on the American political system. One, of course, was Vietnam, which I think has still not quite been forgotten, and I think probably shouldn't be forgotten. But the other one, of course, was Watergate. No president had left office in quite that way before. And what Ford quite correctly called our long national nightmare, it seemed to me, did really shake the foundations of faith in American democracy. So I think, yes, it was a country that had that was feeling very much in need of some clear direction. And unfortunately, though I think his presidency was in many ways a very well-intentioned one, President Carter was not the man to give that clear direction.
You've also talked about the breakdown of a liberal social democratic consensus that had existed since World War II, how a democracy ought to go about taking care of its needs. Was that breakdown coinciding coincidentally with the malaise post-Vietnam and post-Watergate, or were other things also breaking down?
Well, I used the liberal social democratic consensus very broadly. Many people wouldn't like to use that phrase in relation to the United States. But I think there was, if we confine ourselves to the United States, until Vietnam, a broad consensus about domestic and most particularly foreign policy between the parties, and also, I think, a genuine optimism, a feeling that America was getting better, that there were, although there were problems like poverty, like discrimination, America had the capacity to solve them. I think that faith began to erode in the 1970s, and I think that there was then a real search for new kinds of approaches to government. There was also, of course, the realization, which was common to many countries, that the size of government had grown and that a number of the strategies for solving problems, for example, in the United States, the Great Society programs, had unintended consequences.
There was also in the 70s and the 80s a rise of political action committees that shaped what we've been calling the Reagan Revolution. Their influence arrived in part by lucky accident, the change in the campaign finance laws, but also out of a disgruntlement with the way the nation had been heading, yes?
Well, I think I would say two things there. One is, whether it's a lucky accident, many people would say it was a very unlucky accident.
It was lucky for them.
It was lucky for them,
yeah,
certainly.
That's what I meant.
But those who framed the campaign finance laws in the early 70s obviously wanted to reduce the impact of special interests in politics and to try to constrain the effects of money on political life in this country. What they did was to encourage the open formation of new committees, new groups, and to bring into the open participation in politics, particularly business groups, of course, who would have normally been rather careful about participating directly in politics. Now, that's one side of the equation. I think the other side of the equation is the fragmentation of American political parties, so that instead of two major parties putting forward a cohesive program, although it was always much weaker, the party system in America has always been much weaker than in Britain. Nevertheless, I think you see in the 70s a sort of tail wagging the dog movement as the different groups begin to pursue their own aims almost at the expense of the whole. I mean, a point that is made, of course, by Senator Kennedy in the 1980s when he talks about the influence of PACs. PACs become a part of the political process. The whole process becomes much more decentralized and fluid, and it becomes very difficult, I think, to maintain any kind of accountability in American politics, because after all, some of these PACs are here today and gone tomorrow, particularly the special single-issue PACs, which are promoting one interest, be it anti-abortion or some other kind of interest in front of the environment. And their interests are not really, they're only concerned with promoting that particular set of causes. They're not really concerned with the wider public interest. And I think, obviously, that's all right if you've got a mechanism which will integrate them. But as the parties become and the candidates become more dependent on the PACs, the parties can't control them any longer. So you do get this fragmentation of American politics, which again, I think, leads to a sort of loss of direction.
We're talking today with Dr. Gillian Peel. You're listening to Conversations on KUAC-FM. Dr. Gillian Peel is a fellow and tutor in politics at Lady Margaret Hall within Oxford University and has been a fellow and tutor there since 1975. Our equivalent, for those who don't know, might be a full professor in political science here. Her area is politics. The thing that had such power in the 70s was that the PACs, or at least a coalition of PACs, began defining the democracy, the immediate future of the nation. Their power was far greater, I think, than anyone might have anticipated.
Well, I think one wants to draw a distinction. I mean, I absolutely agree. I think one wants to draw a distinction between PACs, which are there really to give money to candidates to protect or promote the interests of, say, a business, and the so-called single-issue PACs, or like the PACs that were formed to protest against the 73 abortion decision, or PACs like NCPAC, the National Conservative Political Action Committee, which began to operate almost like quasi-political parties. And they became very important. They'd often got more access to money than some of the candidates. They offered facilities to candidates, which many candidates needed, training in the new techniques of politics. And incidentally, I think the 70s were also a very interesting period in terms of the advent of new styles of campaigning, particularly the use of direct mail.
The technological
advances were absolutely crucial because the right was able, for various reasons, to take advantage of those changes and to exploit them. The PACs could, by hammering on one or two issues, be very, very successful in reaching a segment of the American public. Now, often the issues which they picked up on, and when we're talking about the Conservative Coalition, the issues were tended to be on foreign policy, American weakness in the face of Soviet aggression, On the domestic front, a large number of PACs picked up, of course, on the so-called family, social or cultural issues, abortion, homosexuality, pornography, school prayer. And what they were basically doing was raising money by frightening people about changes in American society, which many people didn't understand. Now, it seems to me that this is perfectly legitimate in one way, and indeed I've heard it argued that what the PACs were doing was in fact educating part of the American public. In another way, of course, because they had to frighten people to gain money, the impact of direct mail depends upon having a very clear and crisp message which makes people want to give before they throw the envelope away. They distorted many of these issues. But the entrepreneurs, the policy entrepreneurs of the right in that period, were able then to put together coalitions of these PACs and to mobilize groups of people who, for various reasons, have perhaps not been politicized before, and to create not merely the illusion of a major political change and a major political force, but I think also to shape a political movement which in the end led to the, I think, both the election of Reagan, which is one thing, but also, I think, a new climate in the United States, much more conservative climate.
And one of the contributions to that climate from the conservative coalition was it wasn't just the headlines, it was an intellectual justification of the policies they wanted to implement. Isn't that also correct? They knew what they wanted to say, they knew what they wanted to do, and they knew how to get it done, which one would think would be normally the area, the arena of a large political party, the Republicans or the Democrats.
Well, I think when we're talking about the conservative revolution, one can analyze it on a number of different levels. There was, I think, a very important intellectual critique of some of the policies and assumptions and attitudes of the 1960s, which was a valid and a very important contribution to political debate. And I associate with these this level of analysis the neoconservatives, Irving Kristol, Norman Podhoretz, Nathan Glaser, Daniel Moynihan, then, but not now. I think he's obviously moved very much more to the left. These people criticized policy, the policy assumptions and the direction of policy in a very academic and intellectually interesting way, as did, of course, some of the new thinkers in the economic field. They weren't new in the sense, I mean, they had been around for some time, but their message began to get a lot more attention. The supply-side economists and people like Milton Friedman. And I think that what was important about these people was that they did make links with and were able to connect with the foot soldiers of the conservative movement, the people who were in the PACs raising money, organizing, so that there was both a head and a body to the conservative movement in the 1970s in a way that there hadn't been before. You'd had lonely individuals like Bill Buckley, but there was a real movement in the 70s which had an intellectual leadership and got the better of the arguments, I think. And although the Republicans were not initially terribly thrilled to find that much of the activism was going on outside the party, certainly Bill Brock, when he became chairman of the Republican Party in 1976, knew that the Republicans had to tap into that wave of conservative sentiment, that new mobilization of opinion, and to ride it. And, of course, he did. So that I think that there's a sense in which the intellectual level of debate and argument was absolutely crucial, because without it, I think, first of all, the the sort of individual PACs would have lost their feeling that they had the better of the argument. They wouldn't have been taken much notice of. They would have been an incoherent force. But secondly, I think, of course, it did provide the Reagan administration, when it came into office, with a sort of agenda: less government, less taxation, deregulation, back to basics educational philosophy, the transfer of power from federal government to the states, a whole range of things which we associate with the conservative mood of the 80s, but which in a sense wasn't just a gut Republican instinct. It was something which had been thought about and promoted in a way which I think really put liberals on the defensive and the Democratic Party on the defensive. And I should point out, as far as I can see, the liberals still haven't recovered.
Still floundering.
They still haven't found a message.
Once again, this is Conversations. We're talking today with Dr. Gillian Peel, and our topic is the conservatism of the 70s and 80s and what of it in the 90s. I want to take a look at the changes that have been wrought in the economy. The interest levels and tax levels were very high when Reagan came into office. His administration reduced them and trounced them to the extent that George Bush could promise with confidence in his most recent election that there would be no new taxes and everything would be fine without them.
Hmm.
The major thrust of the Reagan message was that the market should govern the economy. Is that so, rather than the government governing the economy?
Well, I think that it was certainly the case that the Reagan message was that government had no place in a number of areas of national life, and that you had to release the energy of American entrepreneurs to make the country wealthier. I think there are two points that I would focus on which were unusual about the Reagan approach to the economy. The first, it seems to me, was that there was a determination to reduce taxes above all else. They thought, they bought the argument that if you reduce taxation, it will pay for itself,
mm-hmm.
because you will, in a sense, be able to collect more money.
From the market,
that there'll be more activity, and that people who might have stayed at home twiddling their thumbs will go out and make more. The argument, it seems to me, is at the very least spurious. I wouldn't myself be at all supportive of that argument. I think that there's no evidence to suggest that people work harder if they know they're going to keep more of it. Indeed, the opposite is the case. I would have thought that there's a very strong argument to suggest that people have to work harder if they know the government is going to take away a larger proportion of their income in tax. But regardless of the empirical evidence, many of these things were articles of faith. It didn't go out and prove that the cutting taxes was going to raise more federal income. You just believed it and did it. And it's, to be fair to the Reagan administration, the sort of whole process of restructuring the tax system was something which became very popular in a number of countries. It was thought that the tax system everywhere, or in a number of advanced countries, needed simplification. Mm. And that often meant cutting the levels of direct taxation, particularly at the higher levels. Anyway, that was point one. Point two, of course, was the commitment which went alongside this of the Reagan administration to boosting defense expenditure, regardless of the implications of that for the budget. And those two things together, I think, have contributed to what is clearly going to be a major problem for the United States in the future, which is the budget deficit. Now, from a conservative perspective, of course, a budget deficit is awfully convenient. It gives you a lot of arguments for not doing things that you wouldn't have wanted to do anyway. On the other hand, I think there must be a real problem for the United States in having so much of its money go in servicing debt. servicing the deficit. And that, I think, which is a novel situation for the United States, must concern any objective observer about the economic legacy of the Reagan administration.
What's your best guess as to the future of the pinch that's created by the deficit and also the need to provide services of one sort or another? We could be tied into a conservative legacy, which is to say, no matter how many programs we want to do, no matter what the consensus of the nation is regarding service provision of one sort or another, we may not be able to do it.
Well, I think one of the most interesting things about the United States at the moment, in terms of its political system, which it's always very hard to get undergraduates to understand, is how unwilling the United States seems to be as a political system to face some of its problems. And by this I mean that Congress, when faced with the difficulty of cutting programs, tends to prefer semi-automatic draconian solutions like Graham Rudman Hollings to actually having to wrestle with the numbers and the programs. They don't want to leave fingerprints on budget cuts.
We'll do it by attrition.
You can do it by attrition, but you can also do it by pretending that it wasn't you that did it. It was an automatic executioner that simply came down automatically. And you can see some of this in terms also, I think, of the way Congress approached the raising of congressional salaries and its handling of Social Security, in the way Congress has tried to get round the very hard questions raised by the thrifts bailout, whole range of issues where Congress or individual congressmen just don't want to face up, it seems to me, to some of the problems involved in making hard choices.
Do you see as much of a muddle in the future as in the present, or do you think that some of the choices will raise their heads in a very ugly way?
Well, I can't see why the situation should get any better. I mean, it seems to me that the obvious thing that our president has to say is if you want to reduce the deficit for the next generation, you have to raise taxes. Now, in a sense, implicitly, Bush has done that, even at the expense of a great deal of unpopularity with his own right wing. But it may be that you need to raise taxes and keep cutting some programs. And it may be that someone like Bush, who has an enormous popularity after a successful war, can get away with some more cuts in defense spending. But I think that there has got to be a very real determination to address those problems, and not the kind of retreat, which of course is all too easy with the modern style of campaigning, into a sort of, oh, well, it's all right, America is great and back again, and you don't need to worry about it. Mm-hmm. It'll all go away if you close your eyes sort of mentality.
Well, with that in mind, what's the likelihood of us revising our thinking and actually taking problems head on from your point of view?
Well, I think there's a real problem that is never in any individual congressman's interest to cut his favorite programs. And the president, of course, although he can bully Congress, can't actually force Congress to do anything that it doesn't want to do.
So the likelihood is not great.
The likelihood, I would have said, is not great. They will just pass the buck backwards and forwards. Right. And I think that this I don't think it's too harsh to call it immobilism, will last for some time to come. Of course, again, there is no incentive to a Democratic Congress to help a Republican president. Congress isn't going to go Republican. I don't think the presidency is going to go Democratic. So you're going to have, again, this kind of built-in antagonism, which simply exacerbates the situation. Although, even if you had a Democratic president facing a Democratic Congress, I'm not sure that that would solve the problem either, necessarily.
Once again, we're talking with Dr. Gillian Peel. She was educated at the University of Durham and at Oxford. She is now, as I've mentioned, a fellow and tutor in politics at Lady Margaret Hall, a college within Oxford University. Dr. Peel is the author, co-author, or editor of over 10 books, The Revival and Reaction, The Right in Contemporary America, was published in 1984 by Oxford University Press. Among her other publications, she is the co-author of The Government of the United Kingdom. The Government of the UK is a leading text on the British government. It was first published in 1980, reprinted in 81. A second edition came out in 1985 of that text. There was also, in the 70s and 80s, a major push to, and not quite drain power from the government, to give more power to the states, to make the states take responsibility, which endures to this day at a time when the states really don't have the finances to take care of those responsibilities. What do you think about the sense of that movement? From a conservative perspective, it makes sense, but in terms of its practicality...
Well, I think if we go back to the ideological fundamentals, clearly the conservatives thought that if you allowed the states more power, you would get more conservative policies. Many states, of course, cannot run deficits. Government is closer to the people. Pressure groups, which are instrumental in pushing for policies which are high spending policies, poverty lobby, are fragmented at the state level. They're much less powerful, and so they thought that the dynamics of state government would be much more likely to give them the kind of policy outcomes they favoured. In addition, of course, they thought that the balance of the constitution had got out of kilter in a number of ways, and the balance between federal and state government was one of those ways. Reagan's new federalism was, of course, one attempt to do that, and it got a big raspberry from the state governors, who knew a bummer up when they saw one. They weren't going to buy that particular package. But interestingly, of course, what has happened has been that as a number of the domestic programs have been cut over the 80s, the states have indeed had to pick up, as you said, or have the opportunity for picking up the gap in public provision, often on the basis of limited fiscal resources. So I think that the states have an opportunity to be enormously creative, to experiment in a number of areas. And the state leadership in a number of areas is often much better than that of federal governments.
Again, because it's closer to the ground, closer to the need?
Closer to the ground, and also in some areas, like education. I mean, it's the very marked difference of expertise. I mean, the present Secretary of Education is getting a great deal of support and approval, I think, because he really does know how education works. I mean, he's not merely a former governor. He is someone who has been through the whole process of restructuring a school system. But if you actually compare what the National Governors Association was saying about education and its program for educational reform with the rather wishy-washy rhetoric of President Bush, who was going to be the education president, I think that the governors themselves actually have a much greater degree of knowledge and expertise. Federal government is inevitably talking in generalities, and it hasn't got the money to do much about it. So I think in many ways the states are in a better position to adapt to what is, after all, a huge country with enormously different situations. I mean, Alaska is not California, is not Mississippi. So that clearly it doesn't make sense necessarily to try and impose the same policies on all states.
Will that be true, and I expect a negative reply, on for all issues? I would think the education closer to the ground, the states could handle it better. Abortion? Question mark. Issues of national philosophy that are where on there's no consensus?
Well, here I think you have a different set of issues. My view on abortion is that you should not impose a policy on women across the board. In other words, that this is a matter of individual choice and individual judgment, and that, yes, of course, America is divided about it, but precisely because it is a matter of personal morality, it is not for the government to intervene. It is a matter of, in the first periods of pregnancy at any rate, a matter between a woman and her physician. I think that the Supreme Court, although it's a very pragmatic judgment, the Supreme Court in 1973 just about got it right. It had a very hard set of interests to balance off, and it did as good a job as could be done. The only problem, I think, which I could see emerging out of the 1973 decision is if medical technology changed so that, in fact, the fetus could survive at an earlier stage. But I don't think... I wouldn't want to see different states having radically different abortion laws, because it seems to me that there is a fundamental inequity in saying to a poor woman in Texas or in Mississippi that you cannot have an abortion, and because you are poor, you cannot travel to another state to get one, whereas somebody in the same position could get one in without any difficulty. Seems to me that civil rights are something which should be nationally protected, and that this is a fundamental issue of privacy. But, of course, I'm very aware that some people do not agree with that. Right,
that opinion notwithstanding.
Yes.
The Supreme Court essentially sent the issue of abortions to the states with the Webster decision. I suppose the conservative thinking was that the states would turn conservative on the issue. They haven't seemed to.
No, I think that it's very interesting that Florida, being a very good example, that where it was assumed that there would be support for a much tougher abortion law, that in fact the political climate was much more in favor of choice than had been anticipated. It may be that we are seeing, the right to life movement rode the crest of a wave in the 80s, and it was supported, of course, by two very powerful forces. One was the Reagan administration and the conservative movement, and of course the other powerful force was the were the churches, some of the fundamentalist churches. I mean, there was an enormous religious support for many of the crusades against abortion. Not all the churches supported it, but many of them did. And I think it's in the circumstances in which the women's lobbies, which were anyway on the defensive, in those circumstances, the women's movement seemed perhaps weaker than it was, and perhaps the extent to which there was support for maintaining the broad outlines of Roe versus Wade was underestimated. Again, when you look at opinion polling, it always depends really on how you phrase the question. I mean, if you phrase the question, do you think a woman should have an unlimited right to an abortion, a very large percentage of the population will quite correctly, I think, say no, because people don't like the idea of people deciding that they want to abort children just because they've got six girls and they've suddenly found out that the seventh child they're expecting is also a girl. But if you, of course, start to be very much more specific and start to talk about the conditions under which abortion should be permissible, then I think you'll find that the public is very much more supportive of, as I say, the broad outlines of Roe versus Wade. And nobody wants to return to the awful pre-1973 days. Well, I say nobody. I mean, some people clearly do, but I think that the public opinion is clearly, sufficient section of public opinion is sufficiently antagonistic to a change in the law to go out and vote.
I want to pick up from that question the general way in which the United States, or a look generally at the way in which the United States works out its moral, ethical, and emotional issues. Are we unusual in terms of the Western countries of the world? We do talk very loudly about issues like abortion, issues like the so-called traditional family values, non-traditional families, whether we accept them, don't accept them, whether they exist despite our acceptance, homosexuality, pornography. We tend to work them out from the tabloids to the White House. Is that unusual, or same thing happen at home?
No, I think there are two very marked features of the United States, which I think makes it different, certainly from Britain. One is, of course, the enormous range of cultures and subcultures, which are all vying for control of the public morality, if you like.
The definition of what's acceptable.
And within that, of course, there is the very much stronger role accorded to, although you think you've got a separation of church and state, the role of the churches is in fact quite strong in this country, using quite in the American rather than the British sense. So that's point one. Point two is, of course, that the Tocqueville's observation that scarcely any political issue in the United States arises which is not sooner or later resolved into a legal issue. And I think the tendency to litigate on everything under the sun strikes many observers as very, very unusual. And to keep on litigating, mm-hmm. Just because you have settled a case at the Supreme Court level doesn't mean it isn't going to be relitigated to try and test certain aspects of it, to test precise meanings of it, affirmative action, busing, abortion, and so on. So I think there is a very understandable clash of values, which comes from a clash of backgrounds and nationalities. There is also a multiplicity of arenas in which to work out those clashes. We have an abortion law. If you don't like it, you can complain to your MP. The MP might put pressure on his party to try and change it. There might be, as there has been, an effort to reform the law in a more restrictive direction. It failed. Okay, that's over. Nobody's expecting that campaign to continue at quite the level of noise that it has been at even in recent years in Britain. So I think it's much easier in some political systems to resolve issues. That said, I think one has to acknowledge that abortion has become a political issue in a number of European countries, that the opponents of abortion and the proponents of free abortion, or abortion on demand, or at least a free choice, have become much more central to political debate, that they have taken their cause to the centre of the political stage in a number of countries in a way that is makes America not entirely idiosyncratic.
I want to go back to your comment about our diversity, our ethnic diversity, and also our multiplicity of perspectives and viewpoints. Does that mean, in your perspective, that we will never resolve moral issues, quote moral, end quote moral issues, and always try to resolve them in favor of one viewpoint or another?
Well, I think there's always going to be a debate. One of the fascinating things, I think, about American politics is the extent to which cultural issues, what is the proper moral perspective, what is the American way of life, what is it to be an American, has played a very important part in American politics. And people, in a sense, particularly, I suspect, groups who are immigrants or second generation, very keen to define themselves against those standards. But given the enormous fluidity and change in the American population, and given the sheer diversity of lifestyle, and subcultures, yes, I think you are always going to have it. Again, I think that America is a paradox, and that's why it's so fascinating to study. It's a people that believes in freedom of speech and in tolerance to a very high degree in constitutional terms. I'm not sure that in practice the actual way Americans behave is actually genuinely tolerant or encouraging of diversity. I think that there is a yearning for some kind of certainty, and much of that yearning does center around family and morality and the, you know, and cultural sort of attitudes.
It's almost as if the Constitution is something we might want to achieve if we were able to.
Well, it's almost as though there is a gap between what the Constitution says and the way people actually behave. I mean, one of the things that one always notices with some amusement, if you go to an American campus, as I am now, that although the students are, of course, very different in ethnic background and in age, gender, they all try and dress alike.
They're all Americans.
Well, they're all trying to... There is a sort of uniform, and I have this sort of feeling that in different... Because they're part of a student subculture, that Americans are very keen to locate themselves in the right subculture and find the right set of values, dress, codes to go with that. It's part of belonging. And that may be the other side of being highly mobile. That is not a fully worked out theory, but I think that there is an endless fascination in trying to work out this paradoxical conflict between theoretical commitment to tolerance and freedom of speech and, as I say, a sort of quest for uniformity almost in actual social behavior and practice.
More definition. We're talking with Dr. Jillian Peel. You're listening to Conversations on KUAC-FM, and I'm Susan McInnes. Among Dr. Peel's other books, The Politics of Reappraisal, Conservative Politics in Western Europe, was an early book published in 1975 by Macmillan. Again, Revival and Reaction, The Right in Contemporary America, published in 1984. The Transformation of Contemporary Conservatism, published in 1988 by Sage. Dr. Peel is a fellow and tutor in politics at Lady Margaret Hall, Oxford University, and has been so since 1975, a past chair of the politics subfaculty at Oxford. I want to turn outward for a minute. One of the things that President Reagan and his administration brought writ large to this nation was a revived attack against communism. We had not seen the likes of an evil empire in 68-point type forever in this nation, and he brought it back very successfully. And yet it was at a time when the evil empire was really wobbling on its legs. Was the success of Reagan's call to arms, so to speak, against the USSR part again of that yearning in this nation to have definite enemies, definite friends, a definite path before us?
Well, I think that the United States has always liked to have some definite enemies. And in a sense, I know you want to turn outward, but I think that there is also a sense in which, if you think back to McCarthyism, that sense of identifying an enemy has had very strong internal or deleterious internal consequences as well. But I think, yes, Reagan did want to sharpen, I think, the message that in the world there was an enemy. And I think that had got forgotten somewhat. I mean, I think that, in a sense, one of the problems of the Carter period was that in emphasizing some of the complexities of international relations, in focusing on human rights policies in a number of areas, in having perhaps too many goals, the overall purpose of NATO and of the Western Alliance had been forgotten. And I think that, in a sense, this is not something which was a feature of American policy, that Mrs. Thatcher would certainly have agreed that it needed to be done across the whole of the West, and she tried to do something similar as well. So I think that there was an attempt to, in a sense, revive America's commitment to defending Western freedom against communism. But also there was a substantive reason for that, which was that this was a period, initially at any rate, where it seemed that Soviet adventurism had taken a great deal of advantage of America's, America's inwardness, but I think certainly American hesitation to act in the international arena and apparent feebleness in relation to Africa, in relation to Latin America, in relation to a range of problems which, in a sense, only tempted, it was said, the Soviet Union to seek for more. Now, I think that as time went by, clearly the Reagan administration's advisors saw that there was an opportunity to negotiate constructively with the Soviet Union, and as you say, the evil empire rhetoric looked very inappropriate as that empire tottered and fell. But I think that part of the reason many of the conservative critics of Carter's foreign policy would say one of the reasons it did fall was that the United States and NATO did in fact begin to exercise a much more determined set of policies. And I think that, in a sense, this is one area where I don't think that Reagan, although maybe he didn't have to spend quite as much money on reviving American defenses, where Reagan's impact was beneficial.
He stood up, called attention to the issue, rattled the saber, and forced the next step to happen then.
Well, I think you can only really negotiate in those circumstances from strength, and I think also there was an internal requirement, which was that the United States had to, as it were, have its mission, as it were, in the world restored. Its belief that it could act constructively in the international arena had to be reinforced. Again, I think that the legacy of Vietnam was a very, very debilitating one. And that had knock-on effects on America's allies, of course.
There has been a strong example of that re-energized mission role in the international arena with George Bush's actions in the Persian Gulf. There was, again, an easily defined enemy, Saddam Hussein, a country which was being victimized, which needed saving. We could literally put on the white hat and ride to the rescue. I keep wondering whether even the Persian Gulf question, but other questions where one might intervene, are going to be that easy in the future. What's your read?
Well, I think that George Bush was very lucky in that his enemy was Saddam Hussein and not some much more complex character whose ideological credentials seemed rather more appealing to people elsewhere. Yes, it could be justified as a very clear case of good against evil. It was naked aggression. Much easier to get an international alliance together in those circumstances. Much easier, of course, to persuade Congress and the American people to support that kind of invasion and that kind of military deployment. Not all international crises are like that. Vietnam wasn't like that. Yet there still might be very compelling reasons why one might want to actually deploy some kind of force in an area where American interests are threatened. But whether America would do so, I do not know. I mean, I think that the Vietnam legacy seemed to me very important in two respects. First of all, it showed that America probably wouldn't want to go to war if that war was going to be long and drawn out. And therefore, there was a very important degree of pressure for getting in and getting it over with. I think the second point is that it was absolutely crucial that Bush could show international support, and therefore the United Nations support was all important, as was the support of a very large number of other countries who sent forces as well, but also that it could be justified in terms of morality as well as realpolitik. And I think American foreign policy has always had this yearning for the two to come together. They don't always do so. In this case, happily, of course, they did.
One thing that came together was the international coalition. Regardless of the luck and the brevity of the war and the success in short order, do you think this does set the stage for international cooperation, or was this a lucky coalition?
Well, I mean, some elements of that coalition are always going to be fairly supportive. I can't see the United Kingdom deciding that it's not going to support the United States in a comparable situation. It might, but it's difficult to foresee a severing of that link. I think it's difficult to know just how far America really feels it's going to be able to impose a new settlement on the Middle East. And obviously, it's got to try. There are enormous pressures for some kind of solution to the Palestinian problem. The fact that Saddam has been beaten has not made the area any more stable. And I think that the United States has obviously got to try to get a peace process going. What that will consist of, and how much energy the United States has for doing that, I just do not know, in addition, of course, to the very real internal pressures which come from having a large Jewish population.
But that you perceive to be in the United States' hands rather than in, say, the UN's? It's not in a position to take over the settlement of that region.
Well, of course, the United Nations could take it over, but then I think if it did take it over, the likelihood is that there would be a solution, or the terms of that process would tend to be rather less to the United States' liking than one which was formulated in Washington. And I think that's always the tension, that you can, yes, you can hand something over to the United Nations to do, but then you, in a sense, abnegate a lot of the responsibility and control.
You have to put up with it.
You have to put up with it.
Yeah. We're in the last 5 minutes or so of our time, so I want to return to a couple of questions about the democracy in which we're living in here at the United States. One is kind of a global question. Do you think that the labels, the traditional labels of liberal and conservative, are any longer of any use? Democrats can think from the right as well as the left, Republicans from the right as well as the left, both can think from centrist points of view.
Well, one of the interesting changes, of course, in the last 15, 20 years in America has been that people have been prepared to call themselves publicly conservative and have admitted to being conservative when asked in polling and other opinion surveys. That again is one of the, I think, important changes. I would remind you that if you went back to the 1950s, very few people wanted to be called conservative in this country. It wasn't like Great Britain, where there was a conservative party that won elections but was actually quite liberal. Nobody wanted to be identified with conservatism, except a few eccentrics. Now, that has changed, and liberalism has got the sort of booby prize for in by way of ideological labels. I think there is a sense in which America is a very unideological country. It's much happier solving problems and dealing in the realities of practical politics than it is in thinking about intellectual or ideological or doctrinal coherence. And to that extent, Hartz, when he wrote his book, which argued that there really wasn't anything but a liberal tradition in America, was right. But of course, there are shades of liberalism. And I think in a sense, the broad labels liberal and conservative mean, and I think have now been accepted as meaning in the United States, is really, are you in favor of big government? Mm. Are you in favor of high spending? Are you in favor of the redistribution of wealth to some extent, or are you not? Where I think there is more of a problem is on the cultural level, because, of course, within that conservative coalition, some of the things that we've talked about, what the conservatives brought together were people who liked limited government in relation to the economy, but wanted to see more authority in relation to the family and morality. And similarly, of course, if you look at the liberal side of the equation, what you have there, of course, most Democrats or many Democrats, while they're perfectly happy to see a fair amount of government intervention in society to solve problems like poverty or to manage the economy, don't want to see government intervention in relation to sexual mores or artistic matters, to mention one area which has become controversial recently. So I think that there is an ambivalence there. But I think the American public probably now knows what it means by liberal and conservative. And I think that to that extent, there probably is a certain use in those labels.
The fact that we've had them well defined between the 60s and the 80s helps us to know whether we are one or are facing one. Is that so?
Yes, that's right. It's a bit like pornography. You know it when you see it.
I wonder what's to come. Gillian Peel, thanks very much for an interesting hour. It's gone quite too fast.
Thank you.
Yes. I'm Susan McInnes. This has been Conversations. My guest, once again, Dr. Gillian Peel, a fellow and tutor in politics at Lady Margaret Hall within Oxford University, has been such since 1975 and is a prolific author on the subject of government. You have been listening to Conversations. I hope you'll join me again next week.